Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record the show on May 10th, the FCC has posted notice that net neutrality rules will disappear on June 11th. That should come as a surprise to all of the media that told you that net neutrality already died on April 23rd. So what's going on? And since abandoning the fight for an open internet is not an option, what do we do now? We'll talk with Tim Carr of the group Free Press. Also on the show, in the Columbia Journalism Review last September, journalist Mary Annette Pember wrote about the value of reporting that represents Native Americans as whole people, with all their frailties and glories, far beyond the 3D paradigm. A reference to the quip from Wildo Wapipa, former Metro editor at The Oregonian, that when Indians appear in the newspaper, they're usually dead, drunk, or dancing. Pember was writing about what looked like the end of Indian Country Today, a major source of news on and for Native communities. But Indian Country Today is back, launching under the auspices of the National Congress of American Indians. We'll hear from its editor, veteran journalist Mark Trahant. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin. All social justice fights intersect in some way, but net neutrality is the definition of a keystone issue. The policy protects the space in which to discuss and debate and organize all the other fights, the means to talk around the legacy media gatekeepers, the ones who tell you that killing people in other countries to force them to change their elected leadership is reasonable. But providing health care for everyone is outrageous. In a sort of slow-motion train wreck, the Trump FCC, led by former Verizon lawyer Ajit Pai, moved to dismantle net neutrality protections only recently won. Millions of people voiced their strong opposition, but were overruled, while Pai and his agency produced a truly bizarre video of him doing a smug victory dance to show off to a bunch of industry lobbyists. But reports of the death of net neutrality, which listeners will have heard last month, might be exaggerated. In fact, the fight, too important to give up in any event, is still underway. Here to bring us up to speed is Tim Carr. He's Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. He joins us now by phone from Hoboken. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tim Carr.
Hi, Janine.
These events, we want to be clear, are evolving as we speak. We're recording this show on May 10th. Lots of listeners will have seen red alert banners across the web yesterday designed to draw attention to the fight. And then just now as I was eating lunch, I read that the FCC has now declared the official death of net neutrality will be June 11th. What is the current state of play here?
Well, it's easy for people to get confused about the various ins and outs of the net neutrality fight. It's a battle that we've been fighting for 13 years now. We did win, as you mentioned, a huge victory in 2015 when we got the Federal Communications Commission to put strong net neutrality rules in place. And those were then rolled back under the Trump FCC and their chairman, Ajit Pai, in December of 2017, voted to repeal those net neutrality rules. And because of the administrative process in Washington, it actually takes some time for that vote to take effect. It also triggered something else, and it's something that we've been working on, and it's why people have seen those red alerts around the web. There is a somewhat arcane congressional process under the Congressional Review Act that allows Congress to reject a rule change. And we have been pressuring members of both chambers, the Senate and the House, to sign on to what's called a resolution of disapproval that would reject Ajit Pai's ruling and restore the net neutrality protections that we won in 2015. It's a bit of a race against the clock because we have to get that resolution passed within 60 legislative days of the vote. So we have a couple of weeks left. And the good news is that the Senate plans to vote on the resolution of disapproval sometime by the middle of next week, around May 16th or 17th. And that would be one step along the way to restoring net neutrality protections. The other thing that you mentioned is that the rule change actually goes in effect on June 11th. So what we're doing is really focusing on the congressional piece, getting the rule itself reversed. But my organization, Free Press, is also very active in the courts. We are suing the FCC, saying that the decision that Chairman Pai made didn't follow a correct process. It was based on false information. So we also have the courts, the Federal Appeals Court, where we're bringing a suit against the FCC to restore the net neutrality protections as well.
Well, and another thing, just to add to that, that seems to be going on is that, you know, as soon as the Trump FCC did this, and it was widely predicted, I mean, you saw it coming up the avenue as soon as, you know, Pai was made commissioner, some states said, well, we can try to preserve net neutrality rules at the state level. Can that work? It sounds a little counterintuitive.
In the absence of net neutrality protections at the federal level, a lot of local leaders have stepped in. And we've had more than 30 states introduce legislation that would restore net neutrality protections statewide. Washington State, for example, has passed net neutrality protections. There's a law that's very close to being passed in California and other states. And also state governors have stepped in to sign executive orders. There are six states where the governors have signed executive orders that prohibit the state from doing business with any internet provider, these phone and cable companies like Comcast and AT&T, that violates net neutrality. And in addition to that, more than 100 mayors have also signed onto a pledge that said that their city will not do business with any ISP that violates net neutrality. So that we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of business contracts that are at stake here. So local leaders have stepped up as well. They're responding not only to the outrage of the decision that was made at the FCC last year, but also responding to their constituents. And poll after poll after poll shows that it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent or any other party, overwhelming majorities of people in the United States support net neutrality rules. We're really pushing back against this very concerted effort inside the Beltway, which has been funded by the phone and cable lobby, to take away these rules against what most Americans say they want, which is these protections for the open internet.
Well, that's what makes it so dystopian. You know, the FCC in name is meant to be the representative of the public, you know, in the telecommunications industry. You have millions of people, you have states, you have communities saying we want this, and then you have the FCC saying, you know, too bad. You know, it seems really bizarre.
Right. This is not the way our democracy is supposed to work, right? You know, the people that we have in Washington nominally are supposed to represent the people who put them in office, which is why we're confident that not only, you know, this is an effective issue around which to organize the public and to get them involved in Congress, but we also have a sound legal argument to show that Chairman Pai was really defying the law itself, the 1996 Communications Act, by making this rule change.
Well, I'm looking through media coverage, and as I'm reading USA Today, I come across this headline. It was a link to a kind of explainer that they had, and it said, "Net neutrality rules are dead. Will my internet bills go up?" And, you know, I think we can all appreciate consumer-focused reporting. And, you know, thinking about cost is, generally speaking, a progressive approach. But in this case, I couldn't help but see it as a really significant misrepresentation of what's at stake here, which is not just a matter of your bills going up.
Yes, I mean, what we've often called net neutrality the First Amendment of the internet. And by that, we mean that it's a rule that prevents your internet service provider from blocking or interfering or throttling with your internet connection. When you pay whatever it is you pay to AT&T, Comcast, or Verizon to provide you with an internet connection, they complete that contract and then they get out of the way. Which is to say, you go online and you are in control of your own media experience. You get to choose which websites you go to, which services, online services you use, and your internet service provider simply connects you to those and provides you with the speed of service that you've purchased. What they're trying to do is get paid at both ends. They're trying to make you pay for access, but also to go to the various websites and services out there and say, hey, do you want to reach our customers? You have to pay us extra. And they can privilege certain websites. In the absence of net neutrality rules, they can privilege certain websites and services. So, for example, Comcast, which has its own video streaming service, could make that work over your connection, and they can hobble a service like Netflix. But I think the point that you're getting to really is about the importance of the internet, not only for that sort of those sorts of business relationships and having customers control that experience, but also as a tool for organizing some of the most important protest movements of the last decade, whether you're talking about Black Lives Matter, whether you're talking about March for Our Lives, the Women's March, of all of these important movements have been organized over an open internet, where the groups and individuals who organize these political movements can go online with the assurances that their access provider won't in any way prohibit their ability to make those connections, to connect with people, and to organize very large movements out of their, you know, their bedroom office or their garage or their, you know, wherever it is that they're doing this work.
Right. We know that, you know, with corporate media, if you can't find an advertiser to sponsor your message, well, your message doesn't get on, you know, and that, of course, is the beauty and the power of a free internet, is that you can get points of view out there that a deep-pocketed corporation doesn't want to sponsor, but that we as a society nevertheless want to hear and want to discuss. Well, I understand also, though, from work by Ernesto Falcone at Electronic Frontier Foundation, that ISP lobbyists are going around the states now, because as we've discussed, states are working on their own net neutrality stuff. ISP lobbyists are going around to states now saying that net neutrality is going to put them out of business. You know, that if they can't do paid prioritization, well, they're not going to have the money to pay for upgrades and they're going to have to charge more, which brings us back to that USA Today piece, will my internet bills go up?
Yeah, well, these are companies that make tens of billions of dollars annually in gross profits. So they're not going to the poorhouse.
Right.
All we're asking simply is that they observe some simple rules of the road and they preserve the democratic principle that makes the internet so important for internet users.
Finally, you want swells of public attention, you know, particularly if there's a time window for communicating with lawmakers, for example. But as much as we want to gin up attention in some strategic moments, we have to see this as a long-haul battle, don't we?
We do, and I think, you know, it's really important that this battle, even though we've had some wins and we've had some losses, has really been successful in mobilizing public support. And there are now tens of millions of people who've taken action on this issue. And we're looking at the possibility later this year that the composition of Congress could change and that we would have a different set of leaders there who support net neutrality. There is hope not only in the short term with the upcoming elections, but over the long term, should a new administration come in to restore whatever net neutralities we may have lost. And so for us, it really is a movement building exercise. It's about getting as many people as possible to understand what's at stake and to throw their support behind protecting the open internet, and also to understand that they have agency, that they can take action, they can call their members of Congress, they can write the FCC, and there are organizations like ours that are standing behind them and will make sure that their voices are heard.
We've been speaking with Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. They're online at freepress.net. Listeners also might want to check out battleforthenet.com. Tim Carr, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
After campus police at Colorado State University pulled two Native American teens off a college tour when a woman told 911 they were definitely not supposed to be there, the school's president spoke directly to concern about white supremacists and their attempt to frighten and isolate people. While if headlines are meant to tell the tale, the New York Times's Native American brothers pulled from campus tour after nervous parent calls police fell rather short. Euphemism aside, listeners likely heard about the incident, spotlighted, like others, via social media. Did you know, though, that fully a third of the senior Interior Department officials reassigned in Secretary Ryan Zinke's recent reshuffle are Native American, even though Native Americans make up less than 10% of the department's workforce? Sources say it's part of Zinke's barely veiled plan to remove obstructions to extractive industry. That news, reported by Alice Olstein at Talking Points Memo, and that's about it, is also a story about indigenous people and their life in 2018 America. Isolated snapshots of outrageous harms are a meager substitute for genuine coverage of a complex community. There are plenty of things that won't be captured on cell phone cameras. Our next guest is dedicated to engaging the wide range of issues affecting Native Americans. Mark Trahant is a veteran journalist and journalism professor, former president of the Native American Journalists Association. He blogs at TrahantReports.com, and now he's editor of the new Indian Country Today. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mark Trahant.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
Well, there's such an informational and narrative void in U.S. media around Native communities and issues with particular impact for them, with the understanding that not all 560-some tribes or the people within them have the same issues, of course. But how is Indian Country today looking to place itself in the landscape? Tell us what the project is as you see it.
Well, I think it's, first of all, solid journalism, letting people know what's going on a daily basis and putting in perspective so many of the challenges we all face. I think if you look at the media landscape, the one thing that's so often missing when reporting about Indian Country is what I call the narrative of excellence, where we have so many remarkable stories about people doing extraordinary things, and they're never told. And so most of the country, all of they do see is just the problem side. They see the challenges. They never see these moments that really speak to what the country could be as well as what Indian Country could be.
Yes. For example, May 5th was just National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, and one wants that crisis to be illuminated very much, you know, but crisis and hardship is never going to be the whole story of a community. And when it comes to minority communities, we just know from experience that that narrative of failure, as I believe you've referred to it, it doesn't necessarily lead to the kind of interventions that we might be seeking, you know, in the first place. But community media has this famous bind where you want to counter the pathological representations of the community. At the same time, you want to present a complex view, which is critical when it's appropriate. But then folks say, well, how can you be critical of us? You know, we're getting killed out there. It's a delicate in some ways role.
Well, in fact, in 1828, the very first editor of a tribal newspaper was Elias Boudinot, and he faced probably the most difficult question ever when the Georgia Guard was trying to push the Cherokee Nation out of Georgia violently, and tribal leaders said, we shouldn't talk about some of these issues because it's going to make it worse, and he argued, no, information will make us stronger, and that debate has gone on in Indian Country, as in most communities, really ever since. Where do you draw the line in terms of protecting a community versus truth and good, solid information? And of course, being the journalist, I come down on that side of the question.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see it actually mostly in the labor community, you know. But as you say, the day-to-day stories and with Native communities, a lot of those have to do with government, with policy, but they get lost. And I know that one policy area that you have been tracking in particular is healthcare, the shifts in Medicaid, the work requirements, and the deeper changes lurking in that for Native Americans, and then the Indian Health Service itself is its own another story. I wonder if I could draw you out a bit on some of the underexplored aspects of healthcare for Native communities.
Sure, and it's a really great example from both fronts. First of all, when the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act was passed in 1974, the average age of death for an American Indian or Alaska Native was in the 40s. And it should be one of the most remarkable stories told is how a dedicated healthcare system has improved the lives of Native Americans. And yet most people write about it in terms of the gap that continues to exist, which is there. And you certainly can write about it. But if you look backwards even 50 years, you think, wow, look how far people have come. Mm-hmm. This is a really remarkable improvement. The same thing is Medicaid. It used to be that the Indian Health Service was by far the biggest funder of health programs on reservations. And even today, that's shifted where, and when I first started reporting, in fact, about Indian Health, I thought it was like the one I grew up with where you went in and saw a government doctor and kind of that treatment plan. And starting in about 1975 up until now, tribes have been saying, you know what, we can do this better. And now 60% of the Indian health system is run by tribes or nonprofit organizations, not the federal government. The federal government role is actually shrinking. The other thing is, in that same time frame, Medicaid has become the primary funder of Indian health. And even more people are still eligible for Medicaid than are in the rolls, so there's still an opportunity for growth. And the great thing about that from a patient's point of view is if you go into the Indian Health Service in the old days and they were out of money, unless you had a life-threatening disease, there was nothing that could be done. Now if you go in, no matter when you go in, and you're eligible for Medicaid, the money is there and your health care follows. To me, and I hear it a lot with, let's create Medicare for all, and I'm, no, Medicaid is much better than Medicare, but it doesn't get as good press.
Well, and the shift to requiring potentially these work requirements, it seems as though the Trump administration is using that opportunity to do some redefining there. Is that true?
There is, I think, a division of philosophical ideas about healthcare. One side sees healthcare as something that is separate and a right and something that ought to be served. And steps like Medicare and state programs and tribal programs are methods to get us there. The other side, frankly, sees Medicaid as welfare. And so they start throwing these other things into it that have nothing to do with healthcare. There's no way to improve somebody's life to make them go look for work when they're trying to get healthy. It costs more. It doesn't improve the system. There's a new study out in Alaska where some of the folks might be in places where there's just not a lot of seasonal jobs, or they might be doing jobs where they feed their family with hunting and fishing. There's other ways of being in an economy, and that doesn't get reflected in Medicaid and a work program. It really is not a very efficient way to do health care. It's much better to say, let's get people healthy and do what we need and then figure out these other economic measures.
And are they saying also that they are not, well, it's race-based, you know, it's not, they're kind of trying to change even the way that Native communities are understood.
Right. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare have recently signed on with these state waivers basically saying that they're race-based and therefore illegal. And that really flies in the face of entire constitutional history where Native Americans are the only people mentioned in the Constitution, and it gives Congress a plenary right to do these kind of programs. So it really turns its head on most of the country's history. And the reason for that is the founders of the United States recognized that tribes were governments. And that idea has really gone through the history of the Republic, where tribes were treated as governments that were here first, and as such, treat their citizens in certain fashion.
Well, when we spoke to you back in September of 2015, the New York Times, in a story about Barack Obama approving the renaming of Mount McKinley to Denali, as Alaska Natives had always called it, the paper called that an effort to improve relations between the federal government and the nation's Native American tribes, an important political constituency that has a long history of grievances against the government. Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but I'm not sure how much the Trump administration or the major media, frankly, see Indigenous people as an important political constituency. But for those that do, what's the story there that we might not know about electoral participation?
Well, first on the big issue, I just don't think you can understand this country's history without understanding how tribal communities fit into the story. It's so essential part of how the country came to be and continues to be and how it's shaped. On the electoral side, I think this is really an exciting year, and I've written a lot about this. First of all, there's more Native American women running for office. There's more Native Americans running for state legislatures. Congress has hit a record for people going that route. Recently, for this TV show I'm working on, I decided to walk from the steps of the Capitol and walked just under 11,000 steps, and that's to represent the 11,000 men and women who've been elected. By the way, one-third of all the women who've ever been elected to Congress are in office now. And in that time, with nearly 11,000 members, not a single Native American woman in the history of the entire country. And this time around, there are four really potential candidates to change that.
That's really interesting, and it sounds certainly newsworthy. We're certainly seeing a lot of coverage of the election, and that fits right in. Well, finally, you wrote of Standing Rock and that battle. This is a fight about story and who gets to tell it. So I want to bring you back to Indian Country today, because we know from inside of journalism and outside, we know that brave storytelling, part of it is having an institution behind you to back you up, to do that storytelling. And I know that you have some personal knowledge there. But what is it, what's most exciting, what do you think folks should look for in Indian Country today, and what are the challenges that you know you're up against?
Well, the big opportunity is we're trying to refashion it as public media, so we'd have to do fundraising and all of that sort of thing, and eager to get out into the public. And I actually think that's a good thing. I think the idea of relying on advertising and subscriptions is really limited, and this allows us to still do some advertising, but it really broadens participation by people, and I think that's really important. So one of the ways we'll do that is all of the things we produce for Indian Country today will be available for other media for absolutely free. And that's keeping with that public media mission of getting the word out and trying to do that. We'll also provide a platform for upcoming Native American journalists, both younger ones and ones who've been around a while. And we'll do that with a combination of fellowships and other ways to kind of support that. I think the idea of storytelling is just essential, and really recognizing there are so many talented people out there that could be telling great stories to the country if they had the platform, and we hope to be that platform.
We've been speaking with Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today. Look for them online at IndianCountryToday.com. Mark Trahant, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.